What were your views on the professionalisation of the game?
Inevitable. Had to happen. Just the way, once you had the World Cup, once the first World Cup was inaugurated, and that was almost inevitable as well. Once you said, we're having a World Cup, there are big prizes at stake, there are big television audiences who are interested in something that's got a meaning and a structure, and you know they can see how people are going to measure themselves every 4 years. Then you started, the New Zealanders were probably already doing it, but they were starting to say, well, you know, if it's worth doing that, then it's worth devoting more time to it. Therefore, we haven't got time to be proper workers, can't do our jobs because we've got to devote more time to it. And people were starting to realise that, I mean, when I was playing, and even my early days as a broadcaster, it was completely wrong and completely immoral that players were attracting crowds of 50, 60,000 people to watch them, and television audiences of millions watching them. And there was money swilling about, and the sponsors wanted to get involved, and there was money swilling about the game, and not theoretically, and probably in actual fact, very little of it, if at all, got anywhere near the players. So it was, you know, they were providing quite a lot of. So it became a sort of those sort of things. You said, how could it have been amateur for so long? Was really the question. I mean, I remember when I first played my first game for England. I came back from Australia and rejoined Gloucestershire, and little Sadiq Mohammed, who was a left-handed bat, Pakistani opening bat, and Zahir were big mates, and they were part of the Gloucester side. And you know, the Gloucester boys said, "Oh, well done, Higgy, you know, played for England, fantastic." But, you know. And Sadiq's first question was, "How much? How much do you get for that?" And I said, "Well, and you don't." He said, "No, come on, you know, you play for your country. How much money do you get for it? What's the salary?" What? I said, "No," and he couldn't conceive of anybody playing at that sort of level without receiving some reward for it. And when you look at it from that point of view, from that perspective, you actually can see, well, how could it have lasted as an amateur game for so long? So when it became professional, it was a sort of inevitability. But of course, because it had been amateur for so long, and because the Blaze had been entrenched, and because there were all these sort of stringent rules against professionalism, it's been much harder for it to move from strictly amateur into the professional era. So there bound to have been some teething troubles, but you know, once it happened, then it was inevitable. Where it goes from here on in, and what the level of salary has to be, you know, is still going to be worked out. But you know,
did you get to know Tom Walkinshaw?
Yes, yeah.
Tell us about him.
Well, I interviewed him a couple of times and found him, I wouldn't say humorous. I wouldn't say he had a natural sense of humour. He had a quiet level of humour, but he was fanatical about what he wanted. I felt that he was passionate about Gloucester, and he was passionate about getting a good deal for the clubs and a good deal for carving their way into this new, completely new territory that rugby had never been into before. And I think rugby was very well blessed to have someone like Tom, who's come from a different environment, different sporting environment, who knows what professionalism is about from the money side of things, if you like. So I think, but in rugby terms, he was fanatic about Gloucester, and he was typical dour, hard Scotsman. But you know, you sort of at sometimes he was so much from the motor racing background that he found it difficult, probably, to gel with the rugby types. And it was always, you know, that the development of profession was always that about how you get the money people and the rugby types who are used to rugby being done in a different way. I mean, clubs in the 70s and 80s, all they had to do was make enough money to keep going. You know, so there wasn't a thing about let's make a big profit, or if you got a few quid left over at the end of the year, what do? Well, you sent the players on a tour somewhere, or you bought them a blazer, or something. It wasn't big money, it wasn't huge amounts, wasn't it? So, you know, and you didn't need to do big deals. Most of the television era, really, the BBC have paid absolute peanuts to the rugby union for the right to stage rugby on the telly, because amateurs. What would we do with all the money if we had it? You know, so. But Tom was a very good man to have for rugby at the time because of the expertise and the difference and the different approach he brought.
It was very interesting when we interviewed Peter Ford. He was saying that when Tom came along, he was absolutely against you know, selling the club to him.
Yeah.
And he now says, and I was wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
That Gloucester wouldn't be the club it is today without Tom.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, we'll see how Bath get on with Bruce Craig and so on. But, yeah, and if you think of Nigel Ray at Saracens, Leicester have done it slightly differently, but just about everybody else has done it through having some one person with big money, big pockets, to bankroll the whole concept and to get it moving in the right direction. Barwell at Northampton, for instance, has done the same sort of thing. And they've been prepared to lose a lot of money for a good few years before they can start saying, oh, yeah, we can make this into a workable business. But... yeah, if Tom hadn't come along with those sorts of viewpoints, then Gloucester would have been stuck in the Bristol mode, looking for, you know, small-time billionaires, if you like, small-time millionaires or whatever, and never quite moving with the times. You know, it's a question, because, you know, rugby's a fantastic game of the people and of the members, and you have to bring on board the people with the money as well, because if you just give it to the members, you end up with a thing like cricket clubs or whatever, you know. I mean... Bristol, during my time, there was an idea of moving Bristol from the Memorial Stadium. Well, it was actually only kept at the Memorial Stadium because the members said, well, you know, we've always come to the Memorial Stadium, we've always been here. You know, there was this, the legacy from the First World War and so on, but their big thing was, because we're used to it here, wasn't, the motivation wasn't what's good for the club, how we're actually going to get the club to make money and therefore be a better club. It was because we're the members, and we've, you know, it's always been in this place. You can't, you have to move with the times, you have to move with commercial realities, I suppose.
Do you remain involved with rugby at all now, Alastair?
I watch it very avidly on that. I don't go to games at the moment, largely because when you've been a commentator, you get the best seats in the house. So anything else is better not to be quite the best seats in the house, because I'm not commentating anymore. I've been to a couple of internationals, and I found that with all the hassle of getting there, and again, because I don't move very well and I've got a disability, climbing the stairs and getting to a position and moving, and it takes a lot of energy. And I found the first time I went, I went in along with the England Rugby International stand, as it were, and great bunch of people, playing mates, etc., etc. But we were in part of the stand where, you know, Twickenham's fantastic because there's no booze laws and so on, but so you can drink as much as you like whenever you like. But that does mean that people are always going to and from the loos, the bars, and, you know, if you're standing, wherever you're sitting, you have to get up, sit down, get up. And your view of the game is actually not destroyed, but it's really fragmented. And then I went to Twickenham and sat in the disabled stand, and you're low down and you're near the centre spot, but all the replacements start running up in front of you, and the water carriers and all these cameramen and all this thing. You go, well, I'm not seeing as much of the game as I want.
Yeah.
So I end up doing that. And club games, every time I get tempted, I think back to the times when, as a commentator or as a reporter, you have to get to a game very early. And you get there early and you plug yourself into a box, and most of them are outside, and you freeze for best part of an hour, and quite often the Bath particularly, the rain's coming pouring through the roof and it's cold and unpleasant, and you're cramped and so on. You're there for an hour or so before the game starts, then an hour and a bit of the game, and then probably you have to come back. So you don't pack up until another hour after the game, and you're being cramped and scrunched into one place for a long, long time, and you're freezing cold, and then you've got to fight your way through the crowds to get home. Every time I think I want to go to a game, I remember that, those experiences, and say, yeah, but I can sit in front of my television, and if I want to go for a cup of tea, I can put it on freeze frame and so on. But I'm sure that I will get the urge to go to rugby again, but just not yet.
When you look back at your rugby career, Alastair, do you wish you'd played for Gloucester?
It would have been fun, but yes, it would have been good. Actually, when I first came to this area, having left school, I came to a place called Thornbury, which is sort of almost halfway between Bristol and Gloucester. So if the call had come from Gloucester, I'd have come up here, but then I'd have had to compete with Pete Kingston for the place and all that sort of thing. So yeah, what ifs, I don't know. I thought your question was going to be, would I have liked to have played in the professional era? Well, you know, for the money, yes, but if I'd been born at a different time, I'd probably never have played rugby at all, because I was a precocious cricketer, and I played for England schools as a cricketer when I was 16 or 17, and the way careers have developed now, somebody would have said, you know, we want you to play cricket, and I would have never even gone to the local rugby club in my gap year and said, I want to play a bit of rugby, a bit of Colts rugby, and got beaten up by Gloucester United. I'd never have done that. I just would have been a cricketer, so I'd never have had the joy of all the great, all of the lovely things I've done in rugby as a player and as a supporter and as a commentator. They would have been totally lost to me. I'd have been a Geoffrey Boycott cricket ball by now. Yeah.
In fact, if you're confronted with a youngster today who has similar skills that you did at both of those games, what would your advice be to him?
Well, the advice would actually be probably unfollowable, because I would say, and I still find it difficult that the coaches can persuade me otherwise, that the more skills you develop in more ball sports, ball playing sports, the more chance you've got of being good at the one that you eventually choose. Because, you know, there are cricket skills that are transferable to rugby, there are rugby skills which are transferable to cricket, you know, in speed and anticipation, all sorts of things like that. There are skills that are very transferable, and basketball, you know, all sorts of things you can do. And I would say play as many sports as you can for as long as possible, and don't specialise too early, because specialising too early, that's what all the coaches want, that's what all the clubs want, and it may actually be impossible not to do that now. But actually specialising too early means that you're putting all your eggs in one basket. And if something goes wrong, if you get an injury or whatever, it's very difficult to get back to being a normal amateur or a normal sports lover or a normal sports player, because you've said, I'm only going to do this, that's all I'm going to do. And it's very, very difficult, and only the few do it in the end. You know, of all the number of kids that want to be the next Johnny Wilkinson, you know, only one's going to be it, and there's going to be thousands of them out there. And you've got to say, well, although the coaches will say you've got to be narrow and focused and single-minded, you actually got to say, well, you've got to keep your minds open, because there are all sorts of other things in sport and in life. And, you know, in sport, you just get one injury and, you know, it's completely gone. So you need to keep lots of irons in the fire. That would be my advice.
I'm very grateful for that.
Yeah, pleasure.
Thanks for talking
pleasure.
To us, Alistair.
No,
it's been a delightful morning.
Well, pleasure. Hope you